Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
A lot of people release stand-up specials online now, and they do feel like they can tend to be like a little bit disposable, and I kind of really wanted to just do something to sort of make sure that mine stuck out as much as it could. I mean, the deeper it got into it, the more I started thinking, this is an insane thing to be doing. Like, this is, there's a way of reading this that is, like, so incredibly narcissistic to have been commissioning. Always thought it would be cool to do some form of art directing kind of stuff for a video game. And as it turns out, the way to get into it is to just commission a game about yourself where you are the main character. It really is that easy. Just pay someone to make a video game about you.
Sifter.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Lightmap from Sifter, our video game industry interview show. I'm Kyle Paletto. Today, comedian Tommy Daslow is with us to talk about Super Daslow Land, his brand new Game Boy Color game. Yep, you heard that right. Before we jump into that, here is what has been making the news on Walkthrough, Sifter's news podcast. Let's go. Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomaeus.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 8th of September.
Concord is cactus as Sony pulls the game from sales and issues refunds.
Acer gets into the handheld game market with the worst named console in history.
Randy Pitchford says, hey, cut us some slack. Even the Beatles had the occasional miss. Who famously didn't?
And the Minecraft movie trailer is out. Expect primary school kids to go bananas.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/discord.
For many millennial gamers like myself, the Game Boy and Game Boy Color era was a pivotal time in forming a lifelong obsession with the medium. 25 years later, after the console has released, Game Boy and Game Boy Color games are making a comeback through a thriving indie development community. Well, now, comedian Tommy Daslow, along with indie developer Tom Lockwood, aka Gumpy Function, have released Super Daslow Land, a tie-in Game Boy Color game developed as a companion piece to Tommy's new stand-up special titled Scam Artist. I've played through all three worlds in the game and had a great time doing it, and I'm thrilled to have comedian, podcaster, and now video game writer and art director Tommy Daslow on the show. Tommy, welcome to Lightmap.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Before we get stuck into Super Daslow Land, tell us a little bit about what your gaming history looks like.
Oh, sure. So I've been gaming since, I guess, the NES era. So kind of since the beginning of the home console era. Lifelong Nintendo obsessive, much to the chagrin of a lot of people who listen to the Filthy Casuals video games podcast that I do. If people are into Nintendo, then you speak their language. There's not enough. You can't get enough Nintendo news in your life if you're into their games. And if you're not into their games, you find any mention of them as a company to be absolutely abhorrent and an offense to your sensibilities. So yeah, I've just always been super into their the way that they do things, their art design, their aesthetics, just like, you know, them as a company. I think there's so many cool things about the way that they operate, for as frustrating as they are. They also, when they swing for the fences and they pull it off, they really do some pretty great and interesting things. And so yeah, I've just kind of I've owned every one of their consoles and then started this video games podcast about 8 years ago, I think. And through, like when we started that show, I had a Wii U and that was the only games console that I owned, which was pretty funny to be hosting a show about video games. And the only thing I could bring to the table was reviewing games on one of the worst selling consoles of all time. And so now with that show kind of becoming, you know, popular enough to that we all make a bit of a living off it, I now play not all of everything, but I play at least a couple of hours of, it feels like almost everything that comes out. So yeah, I'm more in depth with gaming than I've probably ever been in my life at the ripe old age of 37, when you're meant to be settling down and getting too busy with other adult pursuits.
Hey, better late than never, you know, to join the rest of us in the adult gaming world of, you know, anything other than Nintendo. And I say that as a big Nintendo fan myself.
Yeah, I am
also a big Nintendo fan. How does it feel then after all those years of loving the gaming medium to have video game art director and writer on the CV?
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's for a long time, it's been something that I have wanted to do. I mean, most of my artwork is really influenced by that era of gaming, the like 80s, early 90s kind of Japanese sort of design style is like maybe my, yeah, core influence in my artwork and cartooning and stuff. So I've always been, yeah, really interested in that world. Always thought it would be cool to do some form of art directing kind of stuff for a video game. Don't really think I have the necessary skills for like level design and really getting into the weeds of coding and all that kind of stuff. But I've always kind of thought it would be cool to do something like that, but didn't really know how to get into it necessarily. And as it turns out, the way to get into it is to just commission a game about yourself where you are the main character. It really is that easy. Just pay someone to make a video game about you, and then you can live out your dream, finally.
It really is the curse of being a passionate creative, that whatever you get into, you just also want to be involved in the process of it. You can't just consume art without also being like, gosh, I want to get in there. I want to be in there, as if you're not busy enough with all of the comedy and the writing and the podcasting and things like that.
The classic like monetizing your hobby, where you sort of go like, oh, I mean, that's a big part of why I wanted to start a video games podcast all those years ago was, it would be nice for this to like not feel like a waste of time. Like if I turned this into a job, then I could justify all the hours that I spend on it. And then that very quickly goes into like, oh, I got to sit down and play Spider-Man tonight for work.
How quickly it turns, how quickly you realize there's no such thing as a dream job.
Exactly.
And okay, well, I've given a bit of an intro into what Super Dazzle Land's all about, but tell us in your own words what the purpose of this game is in terms of being an accompanying piece to your stand-up special and how it all, the idea came to you.
Oh yeah, sure. So the stand-up special is, it's like half stand-up and then there's a lot of animated sequences in it where I'm talking to these different cartoon characters that are on a screen. And like I said, it's like my artwork is very inspired by video games to begin with. And I kind of, when I was working on the show, I started really thinking about those little segments that are in the show as sort of being like a video game almost. Like there's like a guy that I talk to who's basically the equivalent of like an items shop guy. And there's a big thing at the end where I have like kind of a boss battle on stage. And so kind of realizing that, yeah, like I had kind of made this show that was sort of like a live action video game. And then I was thinking about ways when the show came out, or when the special came out rather, that I could promote it and get it to stick out a little bit, because a lot of people release stand-up specials online now and they do feel like they can tend to be like a little bit disposable. And I kind of really wanted to just do something to sort of make sure that mine stuck out as much as it could. And so last year I had seen on Instagram that McDonald's had put out a Game Boy Color game to tie into it being Grimace's birthday, and the game's called Grimace's Birthday, and they put it out as like a you could play it just on a phone browser or you could download the ROM, and they got a lot of attention for doing this very weird sort of promotional tie-in that was like an actual fully fledged game that was really fun to play. And so I played it and really liked it. And I was just kind of looking up a little bit about the guy who made it, Gumpy Function. And so started following him and then just, yeah, kind of randomly thought, why don't I just reach out to this guy and see if he would want to make a game? I thought it would be really cool to do something that is like a mixed media, ties into the special and is almost like a prequel to the special. Like I thought, oh, what if it's a little video game where you're me, like on my way to the venue. I've always kind of liked that thing of having something that ties into the show that's sort of outside of the show, that's like a separate media thing. And so, yeah, I hit him up, and as it turns out, we live in the same city. he was into it. He liked the idea. He was up for working on it. And then we just kind of quickly went from there, and it kind of started flowing on. Really quickly. I was lucky that he was up for doing it, and he was as into this idea that I was. And the deeper it got into it, the more I started thinking, this is an insane thing to be doing. Like, this is there's a way of reading this that is like so incredibly narcissistic to have been commissioning a video game about you. Like, there was a point where once it started getting a bit more scope to it and we kept kind of adding ideas and adding ideas for levels, and Gumpy was like, oh, maybe we could, maybe we should think about not just putting this up for free and like maybe selling it. Maybe we put like one level up for free. And I kind of felt like the idea of pitching it as like a proper, like paid for thing when it's about me felt too weird. I don't know. Putting it up as like a free thing, like a kind of a promotional thing, felt like I was able to, yeah, gloss over the very narcissistic side of it.
How do you feel now that it's all out and released and, you know, people have had a chance to play it? Personally, I didn't get a lot of narcissism from it. No more than stand-up comedy and that kind of expression, inherently has in it of the medium being talking about yourself. It felt just like a companion piece. So how do you feel about that? How are those narcissism feelings going now that it's all out there?
Well, that's it. I mean, it the whole world of it is so heightened that it's like, it's more just like, yeah, it is a springboard of like the conceit of it is, I wanted to write something that was really real, like 90s video game, stupid, nonsensical story where a phantom appears, he curses me and shrinks me down and traps me in my notebook of jokes, and then all of the worlds that you go through are kind of themed around my stand-up routines sort of loosely. And you have to find an item in a level that relates to a joke that I'm doing and make your way out. And then also my dog is in the game and was going to be in it as just like a little passing thing. And then I realized I could have him like talk to me, and that was like an easy way of getting bits of script, bits of back and forth kind of jokes in there if I'm actually like interacting with someone at the start of each level. So, yeah, my dog has ended up being... I think that's probably the thing that negates a lot of the narcissism for me, is that my dog is almost more of a main character in it now than I am. So I've taken a back seat. I'm the sidekick and my dog is the main character.
Yeah, and Koopy the dog really does stand out as a, you know, the star of the show, I feel. It really is a great representation of how the games of that era felt, where you jump into it, especially when you're a kid and you don't necessarily understand the context of the industry and everything that goes into it, you've probably not even seen the marketing. You might have just seen a cool cover at the store and gone, "Mum, I want this one." And so they don't really screw around with too big intros. It's just, here's the idea, get into it. You know, it could be just a monster, a demon popping out of a notebook is more than enough to just get into the game. And I think it captured that really well. Was the Game Boy Color era a big standout for you? I know you said that Nintendo in general was, but do you have fond memories of that era in particular?
Yeah, I mean, that when that Grimace's birthday thing came out, I had bought an analog pocket not that long before that. So I was like right in the sweet spot of revisiting a lot of those games. And there's the Itch where we've hosted the game. They put a playthrough up of Super Dazzler Land on their YouTube channel. And there's a comment on there at someone going like, yeah, a bit too much dialogue for a game like this, which is interesting because in revisiting that Game Boy Color era and also just the Game Boy era, I kind of forgot how those games are like way more cinematic than I remember them being. Like, I kind of really feel like maybe the NES, probably also the Super NES to an extent, those games get right into it. But the Game Boy Color, it's kind of fascinating to me just how much like I think it's like the second Wario Land game and the third Wario Land game, like they've got like pretty long sort of like cutscene things at the start with like there's like so much more of a degree of animation and movement in that era of game than I remember from playing when I was a little kid. I kind of had it in my head that it's like even more primitive version of like an NES game where it's like everything is pretty static. But yeah, especially that later Game Boy Color era, there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of there is like a lot of cutscene and stuff at the start. But the thing I was most interested in replicating was the I kind of wanted it to feel like an old licensed game where it would be like Mickey, like there's a World of Illusion, the Mickey and Donald one, where they're like they're both magicians and they get cursed and trapped inside their magic box. That was like a big jumping off point for me. Like that era of like those licensed games of that era, they play really well, but in terms of the story, they just they take so much license. Like Goof Troop on the Super Nintendo is a big favorite of mine. And it has no bearing over anything that really ever happens in that show. It's like Goofy and Max go find a treasure map and then they're being like attacked by pirates, and it's like not something that would ever happen in a cartoon of that show. But like, I remember that being such an appealing thing when you were a little kid, like the fact that they had taken this thing and like really springboarded it off into this like way more fantastic realm than the sort of stuff you would get in the show. I remember always being so drawn to how kind of like weird and like wrong they had gotten it in a lot of cases. So I was kind of trying to do something like that with this, where it's like, oh, it's based on this guy doing stand-up comedy, but then he's like, it has absolutely no bearing on reality whatsoever, and his dog can talk. And yeah, I was trying to really do that thing where you get it a little bit wrong.
And there's one bit in there where, you know, you kind of break the wall a little bit by saying, why are the collectibles in the later levels the same as the collectibles that were specifically themed for the first level? And it's brushed off as just kind of like, don't think about it too much. We're here, we're having fun. Just get on with it, you know?
And I think it's very Deadpool of me.
Very Deadpool. Very kind. I also recently purchased a handheld device, an Ambernic, to jump back into old Game Boy games. So this has come out at a perfect time for me as well. And it's, like I said, I think it's just captured the vibe of it perfectly. If we can get stuck into the development side of things. So unfortunately, Tom Lockwood, who goes by Gumpy Function in the developing community, couldn't join us for this chat, but I did speak to him off air, and he gave some really great insight into the process of putting this game together. One thing in particular he said was that the development was just hugely collaborative between the two of you. Can you tell us what that experience was like from your perspective?
Yeah, so I was pretty like, I kind of knew I wanted to do the, like, all the aesthetics be my own. But then in terms of, like, the mechanics and the level design and stuff, like, I just, you know, I don't really have the brain for that kind of stuff. So I was pretty, we did have, like, a really good kind of split in just sort of starting to work with it, where I kind of said, like, look, I'll like do the, like, color palettes and sort of like the look of what I think the level should be. And then, like, pretty much everything else in terms of how it plays, like, I'm really happy for you to just take the lead on that. And, like, you know, you're the guy that does this. Like, you've obviously made some really great stuff. Like, I, you know, I'm not going to get too deep into, like, telling you what to do. If you think something's going to work and feel good, then, like, you know, completely happy for you to, put in whatever kind of mechanical stuff that you want. And so a lot of, like, I would design an enemy and be like, oh, this, I think, you know, this would be good as a little guy that just kind of walks back and forth. And then here's one that I think works as kind of a guy that jumps up and down. And then every now and then I would get a message from him saying, like, I'm thinking of an enemy that sort of flies around and shoots something at you or does this. Do you want to have a think about, like, aesthetically what that could be, like how that would tie into the theme of the level? And that was that sort of stuff is, like, really satisfying to work on, like, just getting a brief like that. That's like, and we worked on this for probably about 6 months total, and it was pretty, like, you know, you get a message like that and then you feel like you've got to, like, really quickly, like, crank out the idea because you don't want to hold up all the other work that's happening. So I really liked getting those messages from him that were just like, oh, can you, like, maybe refine this bit of it a little bit? But he had this idea early on that we didn't end up going with for, like, a reverse Metroidvania, where you would start the game with me with all my abilities and I would slowly lose them over the game, and then it would be me, like, at the very end, just kind of, like, stumbling towards the finish line of recording this special, like, just completely beaten down. And that was a cool idea. I can't quite remember why we didn't really explore it further. I think, like, knowing that I wanted it to go up and be, like, a free thing and be sort of I don't want to sound too callous about it, but, like, a sort of an ad for the stand-up special. Like, I wanted everyone to be able to sort of discover this and have a go of it regardless of what their gaming experience is, which is sort of a hard balance to walk, because you also do want it to be satisfying for actual gamers. You don't want it to be a complete walk in the park, but I also didn't want anyone who's maybe not interacted with a video game since the Game Boy Color era, I didn't want them to open it up and then just be like, oh, I can't play video games, I'm too bad at this. Like, I sort of wanted to, you know, walk that line between it being accessible and also have some depth to it, which is, I mean, they're two completely polar opposite ideas. So it was kind of hard to get that balance. And the riffing on the Metroidvania is, like, that is pretty deep in. Like, that is kind of a thing that really relies on you having that knowledge. So I think that was, I do think that's a good idea, but I think it was just an idea for, yeah, maybe another time. And I'm glad to be, like, time stamping it here and putting ownership of the idea out in a public forum, so that if this idea shows up now, we've got a record that whoever makes this game ripped us off from this podcast.
Can you tell us a bit more about that idea of accessibility? I know there were some very specific choices made to ensure that that it was accessible to anyone, for example, being the fact there is no life meter.
Yes. I think that was the main one, was you can die by falling down a pit. And there, as the game goes on, there are a lot more pits in the levels. We kind of settled on this idea that we have, like, a ranking system. And so you're scored at the very end of the game, and that felt like the best way of having something that's for people that are, yeah, more like hardcore gamers or want that challenge. You can get to the end and see, you know, where you didn't quite get all the collectibles, or especially in the stages at the end, I think if you get hit, like, once, you're going to not get the S rank in the level. So there is, if you're someone that wants to go through and get an S for the whole game, you need to have a fairly high degree of competence. But it's hard too, because like just by virtue of wanting it to be as accessible to people in the sense of not needing to have a, some form of playing the ROM of a game. Like I wanted it to be able to just be played through itch on the browser screen, which then means a lot of people that are interacting with it are using the touchscreen controls on a phone, which suck. It's the worst way to play something. I mean, I ended up playing it a lot through that method just because the Delta emulator app came out kind of halfway through us working on this, which was good in the sense that it meant that when Gumpy sent me a build or something to have a look at, it was really handy to just be able to open it straight up on my phone without having to like go to my laptop, download it, put it onto the SD card, put it into the analog pocket. So it was great for that. But what that has meant is that I've played it a lot on the Delta emulator on the phone, and then I went to try and play it on the embedded browser version that's the version that's on the itch page. And because the layout of the controller is like slightly different on the screen of that, I just have none of the like, I've gotten so used to where the placement of my thumbs is for the Delta app that trying to play it on the other touchscreen version, my fingers are off, my thumbs are off by like a centimeter. So I'm having the experience of someone who's like coming to it fresh on the touchscreen, and like we have a level that's got like a lot of wall jumping in it. And I initially was like, oh, should we maybe like really tone down the wall jumping? Cause it's so hard on the touchscreen. And that was one of those things where Gumpy, I think quite rightly, was like, we still got to have it be a game. Like it's still, at the end of the day, anyone who is like super not into this stuff, if they're going to bounce off it early on, they're going to bounce off it early on. And like not having something like that in there, I don't think is the difference between them sticking around or not. Like there's going to be a drop-off point for them anyway. So like you do have to sort of like, not having a health meter or anything is like a huge concession to accessibility, but then you've still got to have interesting levels in it. If you're just making basically like a walking simulator or visual novel, you know what I mean? Like you're not going to get that same sort of like dopamine hit from people of who like grew up with that era of like platforming games. So
I think it strikes a good balance. You know, there are certain collectibles that are that require like the knowledge of having to something, you know, for lifelong gamers is as simple as, you know, you get to the final frame that you can possibly go to on a platform, and then you do the slide jump from there to reach the extra, you know, the super far away thing.
Yeah.
And so having those things in there and the tiered, reward system for the end of levels, I think that was great. And then if you just want to smash through, it's relatively easy to do that. I think the balance was really well achieved.
I think we struck the balance. And like, again, yeah, I wanted people to be able to like, play through the whole thing of it, and even just, you know, even outside of people's skill levels, just people's time is a valuable thing. You know, like if you make something like this where I want people to like see all the little jokes in it and all the little characters and get to the end and experience the whole thing, and like, yeah, if you make like I'm currently trying to still finish off Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and I'm loving it, but it's such a commitment. Like, it's just like, it's so long, and like putting something like this out, I think there's a few people who have put up like long plays of it or let's plays of it on YouTube, and people generally seem to be getting through it in like 35 minutes, which to me feels like, you know, you sit down, you can do it in one sitting, you can squeeze that in like anywhere in your evening. And then maybe the next night you watch the special, which goes for an hour. It's like, yeah, people don't have all the time in the world to commit to something. And also we don't have all the time in the world to commit to making a homebrew Game Boy game that has 10 worlds in it.
Was the length a accessibility choice more so than a time commitment choice, or was it just the balance between the two for you guys?
It definitely ended up having a bit more in it than I think we thought it was going to. I really liked the idea of it having three worlds slash kind of visually distinct levels. Like it was, we were sort of, we'd worked on the second one and then I was like, yeah, I just have this very stubborn rule of three in my head. Two just kind of feels like you've done one that looks different and then you're out. Just kind of felt weird to me. I was like, you kind of do need like a third one in there that's like aesthetically got a lot of difference to it from the other two. And then, yeah, like Gumpy is like a he's a such a like driven, like really cares about the quality of what he's making. So a lot of times he would be getting pretty burnt out and then he would get into the weeds on a level and be like, oh, I've had another idea for like another enemy that we could put in. So like we'll spin off and we'll make another level in this world. So it kind of, a lot of it grew very organically from stuff like that, from him just sort of like, you know, yeah, he's really passionate about this stuff. So once he's working on something, even if it's like the deadline's looming and he's having to crunch and whatever, he's just having more and more great ideas. And, you know, like a lot of creative people, like if you think of something that can go in there, you want to put it in. If you decide not to put it in because you're running out of time, it feels like a concession. That feels like you're sort of, you know, it's always going to be in the back of your head of like, oh, I didn't do as much as I could have with this.
Yeah, I think that it's clear in the work and in the conversations I've had with him that he's just an incredibly passionate person about the medium and loves what he does and really enjoyed working with you on this. And yeah, I think that fun comes through in the game. So well done to both of you.
Yeah, I hope people, I mean, on Filthy Casuals, we talk a lot about games that are trying to be funny, and it's a real bugbear of ours as three people who are professionally comedians. Like, we have this running thing on the show of I feel like anytime a game is like mildly, you know, not even necessarily funny, but has characters that are kind of quippy, we have this thing that we're obsessed with where IGN always have a thing in their reviews where they'll be like, and the script frequently had me laughing out loud. And then we play the game and we're like, this is some of the most unfunny shit we've ever seen. Like, but they always use that specific phrasing, which we really enjoy.
I don't think I've ever laughed out loud at any video game. It's incredibly tough medium to do comedy well in.
I think that game that's just come out recently called Thank Goodness You're Here is genuinely really funny. I had a good time with that. But it is, I think a lot of the times when a game gets reviewed as being funny, it's just in that real kind of like Marvel movie way of like the main character is kind of quippy. And it's not that like necessarily like funny stuff is happening in the game. It's just like that the tone of it is a little more like not very self-serious and a little more kind of, you know, yeah, casual and a bit, yeah, quippier. But anyway, from years of having been very critical of the attempt at humor in video games to now making one where I was in charge of writing, yeah, little bits of dialogue at the start and end of every level, I was really like, man, I've really made a rod for my own back here. Like I'm the comedy critic that then tries stand-up, which is such a like hated thing in the industry of like, well, look who thinks they're funny enough to have a go. And again, like you were saying before, the fourth wall stuff, like that was something that I got really self-conscious about, because to be completely honest, I think that style of writing is like, it's just really easy. Like it's just super easy to make a joke where you go like, oh, I'm in a thing. And so I was a bit like, I toned some of that back because I was like, well, you don't see a ton of that in video games. And if I've got a good joke for it, I want to have it in there. But I don't want every joke to just be like, oh, we're in a video game. Because also, like, you know, it's like, well, we're not in a video game. We've been sucked into my notebook and we're trying to put my jokes. So, you know what I mean? It's like, which one is it? Am I aware that I'm trapped in this thing and I'm trying to get out? Or am I aware that I'm part of a video game? Like, yeah, I really like the week before About a week out from releasing, I sent Gumpy this document where I was like, man, I've rewritten the whole thing. I'm so sorry.
I was about to ask, did Gumpy at any point have to pull you up and say you might be overthinking this?
No, again, like because he gets it, he has, you know, his own versions of that stuff where he's like, you know, once you have that thought, once you get obsessed on that idea, it has to be in there, and you know that it's going to feel shitty if it's not in there, and you're going to look back on it in 6 months' time and be like, oh, I wish I'd argued to have this in. Like, I really feel like I, you know what I mean? Like, so I think because he's got his own versions of that stuff, he, to his credit, he wasn't like, brother, I cannot do this. He just got down to brass tacks and just, yeah. And I'm when I played through it the final time, I'm like, yeah, I'm glad I changed these couple of jokes here and there, because there was just a couple of things that just, you know, that classic thing where you're like, this was a placeholder like 6 months ago. Why have I never fixed this? Like, I just kept meaning to return to this and fix it up and make it better. And it's like, I've got to actually do it now.
How has the response been? It's been out for nearly a week now. Are you hearing much feedback? Are people, playing it and watching the comedy? Has it all come together for your fans?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know with something like this. Like, I don't know if it's possible to see the exact numbers of people that have played it. Maybe it is. I'm not sure. But I do know that there's a donate button on the site, which I hadn't promoted in any way, and has apparently been going pretty well for us, which is good. Working on this and getting the stand-up special ready at the same time, the big fear is that you're going to drop these two things and you think they're really cool and interesting, and you really do have to brace yourself for the idea that you might put this stuff out and no one cares at all, and it does not move the needle in any way. So I very, like, the day that we posted about it, I was like, God, what if all I get is just like, I mean, this is such a niche thing to put out. What if all I get is like, you know, one Instagram story tagging me in it? What if it becomes apparent really quickly that no one has played this at all? But no, I feel like I've been getting a lot of people kind of tag me and stuff and like post their high score pages at the end, which is cool, which is what I was hoping for. But because it's kind of tied into the special as well, I had this day or two of pushing the game, really wanting people to interact with that as the lead in to the special, and then had to kind of focus on the special. The like premiere of that was on Sunday, and so now that they're kind of both out at, and you know, people can just go and get both of them at the same time, it kind of feels a lot easier. Like, I kind of really went back and forth on like what's the best time to put both of these out. Like, I wanted the game to lead into the special, so I didn't want to put it out like 2 weeks before or anything, but I also wanted to give it like just enough room to breathe on its own. I've been getting a lot of really good feedback, a lot of like friends playing it with their kids, which is cool. Seeing people post about it on just like different versions of hardware that they have is cool. Like, some people have like original Game Boy Colors that they've like, refurbished and stuff like that is really cool. And then I didn't realize what a community there is of people on YouTube who just will play through literally anything and put it on their channel. I keep getting tagged in like maybe one video a day of a channel that's got like 80 subscribers and has played through my game, which is cool. Like, everything helps. So yeah. So that's neat to see that it's got some sort of, and it's, I think it's still, it was number one on the featured section of Itch for a little bit. So yeah, that's cool. And next step is doing a physical edition to get out there with like a manual and all that kind of stuff. So I'm working on that at the moment. And I had this idea an idea that I originally had for the game that, again, I abandoned because it was just too niche was I liked the idea of making the entire game in Japanese and that it would be a game that had never been released outside of Japan. In spite of the fact that...
laugh, it's just a great tie-in to the comedy opener of the special where you talk about how it's no surprise that that someone like yourself might be obsessed with Japan.
Yeah. No, 100%. And I really liked the idea of it being... the joke of it being this forgotten relic from another country, I just thought was really funny. Like, why would that ever have happened when I'm an Australian comedian? Why would there have been something about me that only ever came out in Japan? But what I do want to do, so I was there in February and we were working on this at the time. And so I made up a like a fake Japanese box of the game. And I went into Super Potato, the retro game store in Akihabara, and I snuck a copy of it onto the shelf and just filmed myself doing that to put out a little video. I was like, oh, I'll film this for like when the game is out. So I've got like a little thing to post about it. But then the more that I think about it, the more I'm like, I actually do just want to make it, I want to get it translated into Japanese and get maybe just a handful of, when I get the physical version made up, get a handful of them made up with the Japanese language on it and go over there and have like a pop-up stall somewhere. Or my friend was like, you should drive, you should see, hire a car, see how close you can get to Nintendo headquarters in Kyoto without being moved on and sell them out of the boot of your car, work out the closest distance that you can get to Nintendo without getting in trouble and sell them there. And I was like, man, that's such a good idea.
I absolutely support that idea. I would love to see if the context of the game is lost in translation and you know, without that context, just how absurd
it would be
for someone almost to pick definitely. It up and be like, what is this? You know, I guess similar to how it would have happened back in the day if you managed to get your hands on an obscure Japanese game that was only in Japanese with none of the context.
Yeah, those games that never used to be released back in that never used to make it over to the West because they were like, people just won't understand what's going on here. I went to, I don't know if you're familiar with what's called 84 Hashi, the cafe in Tokyo that's owned by a guy who used to work at Nintendo, and it's like secret location. You have to like book through a tour guide company and then they like meet you in the street. They don't give you the address. They like meet you in the street and walk you there. And it's just this cool little cafe. It's this guy who he worked on, I think he worked on like Earthbound and Pokemon. And so he's got this cafe where he's got all this memorabilia. He's got like drawings of Mario on the wall that Miyamoto did for him when he opened the cafe. And he basically just, you just go there and you hang out with him for like 2 hours. I think the biggest group you can be in there at one time with is like maybe 8 people. But I went with my friend Ben and there was like one other guy there, and he doesn't really speak English. So you just vibe with him and go back and forth via a translator. And so he's like he's so into like meeting people, and he's, you know, you tell him where you're from and he's like clearly just jazzed that people from other parts of the world have any interest in this, you know, stuff that he's done, and loves meeting people. And so he'll follow you on Instagram once you've been there, and he's like, we had been recommended it by a friend who's in a band who had been there like 8 months before. And we just mentioned that guy by name and he remembered him. Like he knew who he was. He's like, oh yeah, the drummer. Like he's super into like keeping up with the people that have been to his cafe. So anyway, now that the game's out, I thought I'd send it to him. And so because he doesn't really speak any English, I had to go onto like Google Translate and write out a message and translate it into Japanese, being like, hey, I went to the cafe. I thought you'd like to see this game that I made about myself, and like just sent it to him. Just been left on read so far, which is completely fair enough. Like,
yeah. And are you assuming that he got it? He's played the game in full and has ignored you based on that, or are you hoping that maybe he just hasn't got around to it yet?
Ooh, no, I hadn't really considered that. I was banking more on the idea that Google Translate, this is what I was telling myself, to spare myself the embarrassment, Google Translate did such a bad job of putting my message into Japanese that the block of text that he got from me makes absolutely no sense, and he hasn't been able to make hide nor hair of it.
Look, that's the most likely scenario for sure.
Yeah, thank you. Definitely. Thank you. Yeah.
Before we finish up, do you have a recommended order in which people should consume these two pieces of media, the game first or the special first?
That's a good question. I think I really think either way. I mean, technically, the game takes place right before the special as I'm working on it, so chronologically. But then there's a couple of things from the special that are in the game. Like there's a bit where some of the ideas that I've had of for little characters that are in the special come to life in the game and are kind of attacking me. So that's definitely something that if you've watched the special first, you would have more context for those little characters coming to life.
That's how I did it. I special first, then the game, and it was really fun to see the characters pop up and, you know,
yeah.
enemies and
bosses. And in fact, one of the characters from the special that's in the game is voiced in the special by Dania Walker, who is one of the only people in the special who plays video games. So it was cool that her character got to be one of the ones that's actually immortalized in the game.
You can find Tommy's new stand-up special, Scam Artist, as well as links to play Super Dassalo Land at tommydassalo.com. The game is playable right now. It's super easy in your browser, or you can download the ROM to play on a handheld device. And we'll pop all of those links in the show notes. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug, Tommy?
No, if you just go to my website, you can find me on all the socials and stuff from there and keep an eye on when I have tour dates and stuff coming up. But yeah, those are the two things that I just love people to have a go of.
Well, I'm going to plug it for you then. I know you've mentioned it a couple of times, but if you like video game journalism, like what we do here at Sifter, but with a bit of a lighter spin and done by some genuine comedians, you got to check out Filthy Casuals podcast. It's an absolute ripper.
Thank you. That's a good point. I should have edit in me saying to listen to Filthy Casuals, because Ben and Adam will kill me for not taking this opportunity to plug our work.
Well, tell Ben and Adam, don't worry, that I've got their back and I've stepped in to cover for you with that one. Thanks so much for joining us, Tommy, and good luck with everything that comes next.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This has been Lightmap, Sifter's interview podcast. Sifter is produced by myself, Fiona Bartholomeus, Courtney Barrett, Daniel Ang, Adam Christou, and Chris Button. Mitch Loy is senior producer, and Gianni DiGiovanni is Sifter's executive producer. Thanks to Audio Technica Australia and Apple for their support of Sifter. And have you subscribed to Sifter's YouTube yet? It's super easy to do. Hit the subscribe button and make sure you turn on notifications to get an alert when we release a video. You can get episodes of Lightmap, this podcast, our interview show, Walkthrough, our news show, and Drop Rate, our review show, in tasty video format. Head to youtube.com/sifterhq to give us a follow. That address again is youtube.com/sifterhq. We'll catch you on the next episode of Lightmap.
Hi, Chris Button here from Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. Star Wars Outlaws gives you a unique look at a galaxy far, far away, with a focus on the scheming, unforgiving criminal underworld.
I thought, when playing originally, that Nyx would have been sort of like something I'd use occasionally, but it became pretty integral to the gameplay. You're kind of always like looking at the angles and seeing, well, okay, what can I do over here? How can I cause a distraction? Do I want to set an explosion off over there to draw attention over there? Or do I want to use that explosive barrel to blow up a few enemies? So, you know, there's a quite an interesting variety in the way that you can approach each particular, which I found really fun. When it breaks bad, you're just like, all right, here we go. It's Star Wars time.
So does it deliver on its galactic size potential? Find out on Drop Rate, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.